I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A few weeks ago, Chester Holman III was back in a Philadelphia courtroom where for years he had claimed his innocence and heard the judge and a prosecutor apologize to him for his wrongful conviction. Judge Gwendolyn Enbright told the court that the prosecution's behavior had been a, quote, disservice to Holman and to the criminal justice system, which must rely on the integrity and forthrightness of all the parties. Chester Holman had spent 28 years in prison, accused of murdering a Penn student, Tae-Jung Ho, in Center City, Philadelphia, in 1991. Two witnesses who had originally identified him had recanted their testimony years ago. Evidence that was reportedly withheld by the prosecution could have led to a different suspect. Chester Holman III joins us today on Radio Times to tell his story. He's back home in Wilmington, Delaware, readjusting to life as a free man. And Chester Holman, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Alan Tauber, and he's Chester Holman's lawyer. He's also an attorney in private practice who focuses on criminal defense and civil rights. Alan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I'm so pleased to be here, particularly because it means Chester's free.
Absolutely, and we will be talking all about that. I should add that the prosecutor who apologized to Holman is here as well. Patricia Cummings is an ADA in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, heads up the department's Conviction Integrity Unit. And Patricia Cummings, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. If I can begin with you, Chester Holman, and I know this is you're a free man, but it's also very painful, and I understand that. And I just want to know how you're doing.
Just taking it one day at a time.
Yeah.
To be free. Like, I'm just embracing the my freedom. For so many years, I was just focused on getting through the day in prison. You know, and like I said, I've told people before, I've never envisioned life outside of prison.
Yeah.
You know, so now I'm just like basically trying to find my way through. And each day, I'm like I said, I'm getting stronger, I'm learning more, and I'm just trying to take it one day at a time, one step at a time. And as I go along, I'm just like, in awe of life, and I'm really taking it in. I'm not trying to miss a second of it. So I move very slow, and people that are around me may not like that or understand that, but I'm just trying to take it all in. I don't want to miss another second of what I'm experiencing.
That was 28 years ago. You were 21 years old.
Right,
you were a young man at the time.
Right.
And never had a criminal record.
No.
I should say to our listeners that you got a dog, and we were talking about that before going on the air. In terms of things that you need for yourself.
What do you mean? As far as...
How is a dog helping
you? The dog is great. I think that was probably, I don't understand why or how it came about, but making that decision was probably like the best decision I think I made prior to coming out of prison, because, I find myself sometimes at the house, and, I'm there by myself sometimes, and, the dog is just like, it's been very comforting for me, and it's also, I'm familiar with the dog from prison.
Right.
It's been a great experience for me having the dog. I mean, now these last few days the dog's been a little rough, chewing on the furniture now. But aside from that,
you got to get used to that,
right? So I got to train her a little better. But it's been great, having this dog.
You changed the dog, the name from Buttons to Journey.
Yes,
Journey. Yeah. Journey seems like a really powerful name for a dog.
Well, the thing was when my institutional job at Back in Retreat. The supervisor.
That's where you were in prison.
Where I was in SCI retreat. The supervisor, he said to me, you have the potential. You possibly can be getting out of prison, so maybe you should think about adopting one of these dogs. And I had thought about it before, but I just wasn't, because I said, well, I might not get out, and I'm not going to go through that. So I took the chance, and I said, you know what, I'm going to try to get this dog. It was like 8 months old, and she had just got there. So I went home and I called myself. I mean, back to the block, and I called my sister. I said, "Look, can you call the Zurn County SPCA and see if we can adopt this dog?" And she said, "Are you sure that's what you want to do?" And I was like, "Yeah." So she went and did that. And my whole premise behind it, the process was that I had been in prison so long and I had come in so young, and if I was able to get out, I wanted to take something with me that was positive, and because I more or less died in there, because like I said, my spirit and my hopes, everything. So me leaving prison, I wanted to leave something. Yeah. And taking the dog was a new life, a young life, and something I can maybe possibly grow old with. So I just thought it was fitting for me to, do that. And And that's how I did it. That's what I did. And that's why I got the dog. So I'm growing. Hopefully we'll grow old with this dog.
You know, and, chew up all the furniture on you.
And experience, you know, and watch this new life grow into something. So it's just, you know, it's weird, but, you know, that's how I look at it.
Nah, you're looking at a dog lover. So I totally get it. I want to get back to you, Chester, but let me turn to you, Patricia Cummings. You apologized to Chester Holman in the court. What did you say?
Boy, I can't say that I remember exactly what I said.
But it was important to apologize.
It came from my heart and my gut, and I think I prefaced it with, we filed papers in the case that talked about legally and factually what occurred, and they spoke for themselves, but the only thing that they didn't say was, I'm sorry. And I've been doing this for a long time, and one thing that I have absolutely learned about the criminal justice system is it's not very good at admitting when it makes a mistake, and even if it does, often there's never an apology that goes along with it, and it's so important for the human spirit.
Did that mean something to you? To hear, it was the judge and also...
Yes, it did.
To say, I'm sorry, or we're sorry.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. You know, that was, you know, cause like I said, I know they didn't have to say it. She didn't have to say it. You know, she could have just presented the case as it was and moved on, you know. But for her to say that, you know, it just, you know, because this whole situation, like I said, it's about, I mean, I understand I'm the one that went through it, but I always think about my mother. I lost my mother through this, and, you know, and, you know, she fought for me and she believed in me, and, you know, I took that as, I don't know, letting her know, Ms. Cummings and the judge saying, you know, they were, you know, sorry. That it was letting my mother know that, you know, it was all right. And, yeah.
We'll get back to that. Alan, let me get you in on the conversation. How often does that happen in a court
room? Never in my life have I heard an apology from the government. And I just would like to say this, that I've been working in these courts for 30 years. I've taken guilty verdicts where I thought people were innocent. I've had people acquitted. I've got civil judgments where people were compensated. I have never – none of that compared, quite frankly, to hearing an apology from the Commonwealth and from the court. It was probably the most powerful moment I've had in court in my career. People, you know, there is – you know, our institutions, the government is at best generally very indifferent to people's feelings and to their time and everything else. And, you know, it's not a day goes by we don't hear stories of anger at the government or frustration and bitterness. To hear that, to put a very human reaction from the government was just really it was shocking to me. I didn't know that was coming, and it was very overwhelming to hear. I have to tell you that.
Do you think it's something about this case, something about Chester Holman? I mean, something about the people involved that led to this apology? As you say, a rare occurrence in
right.
a courtroom.
I mean, there's no question that it's the people involved. I mean, there are many ways in which a case can be like this can be resolved. I've had. Not many, but other examples, other cases where there's been exonerations, and there's not an apology. You know, it's a very businesslike transaction, and everyone gets up and walks out of the courtroom, and you know, you're just grateful that justice was done. This was about. I mean, there's really no other way to say it. You know, Larry Krasner,
district attorney,
has brought a different approach to the idea of justice. He's brought humanity to the criminal justice system. Patricia Cummings, you know, bringing Patricia Cummings here is probably one of the best examples of that. I mean, she has enormous experience in this field, is a remarkable professional, but has, you know, real empathy as well. And I think it's a phenomenal thing.
Let me go back to you, Chester, and you know, not to relive those 28 years, but, you know, putting myself in your shoes, trying to imagine I'm innocent. I did not do this crime. I've never had a criminal record. I happened to be the sort of wrong place at the wrong time. I had witnesses that that pointed to me. Then they recanted. There was a lot of lying and withholding of information. How were you able to kind of maintain a kind of sanity while you were behind bars?
Well,
and again, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes.
I mean, the first few years leading up to trial, waiting to go to trial, I just figured it all was going to work itself out. You know, I just figured the system is, you know, it might be slow, but it's going to, you know, I never imagined that something like this would happen. I just didn't think it. So, you know, that first initial phase when you're going through the preliminary, when you go to preliminary and so forth, and then I said, okay, it's not working out. So I said, well, when we get to before a judge is going to see this, and the court's going to see this, or a jury's going to see this. And then we get to, you know, we kept getting further and further along, and then, like I said, after the trial, it's like they found me guilty. I was just like, you know, what happened here? So, you know, I lost a little bit of myself there. But sure. Like I said, you know, my mom has always been my, you know, my saving grace, so to speak. You know, the one person that's always, like, you know, truly believed in me and, you know, loved me for who I was. And, you know, so, and my mom, she was on dialysis for many years, my whole life, matter of fact. So watching her, you know, struggle to go to dialysis and come home and, you know, take care of us, me and my sister, in the house and so forth. You know, I showed a lot of strength. And then my father would work, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours and come home and still do yard work and so forth. So I had that, you know, that I witnessed that. And so
a strong family.
Right, exactly. So when all this happened and I turned around and I saw them crying, you know, I didn't want to go through it. I said, you know, there's no way I'm going to do this. But I couldn't turn around and, you know, and say, well, I'm going to end it all, or I just had to keep going for them, you know, because I didn't want to bring more pain to them. So that was my focus for a lot of years. And then, yeah, like I said, when my mom passed, I looked at my sister and my father and my grandparents, and I said, so I basically did it for other people.
What does that tell us, Alan, about your client here?
I mean, one of the things I observed about Chester, I mean, I worked with him for 15 years, is he displayed such amazing restraint and dignity through this process. I said in court that it was a great presentation of grace, because never once did he express anger or hatred at the people that were involved in putting him in jail. There were witnesses who gave false testimony. I was so amazed at this. I said, how do you not have anger at these people? And Chester's response to me was, well, I see them as victims as well. Uh-huh. And it's just, I mean, he's been really an inspiration, quite frankly, the way he has handled himself. No one would have begrudged him having fallen into despair or bitterness or anger, given what was taken from him. But he never did.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about Chester Holman III. He was released from a state prison in Luzerne County last month after serving 28 years for a murder he did not commit. Also with us, his lawyer and a district attorney here as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Chester Holman III. He was released from a state prison in Luzerne County last month in July after serving 28 years for a murder he did not commit. Prosecutors have acknowledged that he was likely innocent for a murder that took place in Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia back in 1991. A judge and a prosecutor apologized to him in court. Alan Tauber is his lawyer. He's also an attorney in private practice who focuses on criminal defense and civil rights. Patricia Cummings is assistant district attorney for the city of Philadelphia, directs the Conviction Integrity Unit. And as I mentioned earlier, she is the prosecutor who apologized to Chester Holman. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Patricia, let me go back to you, and let's go back to August. It was August 20th, so really 28 years ago, 1991, there was a murder. A Penn student was murdered near Rittenhouse Square in Center City, Philadelphia. What happened?
You know, I don't want to turn my description into a cliche because there's really nothing cliche about this. But the bottom line is, I think a tragedy occurred in several respects. None of us can forget the fact that two foreign exchange students became the victim of a very serious crime. One died and one survived. Separate and apart from that tragedy, another tragedy occurred. And how I describe it is it occurred as a result of a strange, simple twist of fate. The first time I read anything about this case and talked to Chester's lawyer, it was pretty clear to me that, wow, strange coincidence, because Chester, his life changed because he was driving a white Chevy Blazer at the wrong place and the wrong time.
With a license plate that had several letters that seemed to line up with letters in another van, I guess.
YZA, and I'll never forget that, YZA. You know, one of the first things I learned about the case was there were several other people that were driving a white Chevy Blazer with YZA in the license plate in Philadelphia on that night. So, unfortunately, nobody seemed to pay attention to that. Nobody seemed to care about the significance of that fact occurring on that particular day.
You've also got two eyewitnesses, a man named Andre Dawkins and a woman named Deirdre Jones. I'll turn to you, Alan. Mm-hmm. And they originally identified Chester.
Yeah, Deirdre Jones was a friend of Chester's, and they were out for the night. She was, I believe, about 20 years old. She had no record. She had never had contact with the police. She was the passenger in the vehicle. And when the arrest happened, both Chester and Miss Jones were brought to the homicide division and separated and kept apart. And eventually, Miss Jones was given a statement that had an enormous degree of detail that had been gathered by the police from numerous eyewitnesses throughout the night. Was given a statement and asked to sign it. She was told, and she's testified to this, that Chester had confessed. They showed her a statement of his. He actually had given an exculpatory statement explaining all the innocent details of the night. They showed this to her. She didn't read it. And said, he's confessed. He's going to jail. You can go to jail for the rest of your life, or you can be a witness for us and walk out of here tonight. She had two small children. You'll never see them again. We don't need you, but if you, you know, but we can charge you and send you to jail as well. So what do you want to do? And she was a very innocent, inexperienced person. She had been asking for a lawyer all night, and she was denied the lawyer.
This is in the Philadelphia Police
That's
Department.
Correct. Okay. And she had been asking for a lawyer all night. This is all based on her own account. Was denied a lawyer. And eventually she said, fine, if he's confessed and he's, you know, accepting responsibility for this, what have I got to lose? I'll sign it. And she walked out. And she was never charged with anything in connection with the case, though the police had made her out to be an accomplice. She was never charged, and she walked out. This is obviously a statement she later recanted. She has told me and many others who've talked throughout this case that the years have passed, the guilt she suffered, the depression she suffered. And she eventually basically said she couldn't live with herself anymore. And she came forward. And it was a very dramatic statement she gave to our investigator when she ultimately relieved herself of what had happened.
This was in 2012, right?
She originally recanted in 2005.
2005.
It was not till 2012 that we ultimately got a hearing on this. Prior district attorneys fought us on this. We had to get an order from the Superior Court, the Pennsylvania Court of Appeals, that ordered the Court of Common Pleas to give us a hearing so that she could even that would even allow her to testify in court to what had actually happened. And that didn't happen until 2012.
Now, my understanding, I have to say, I read a lot of the Philadelphia Inquirer that has written about this case for a number of years now. But Dawkins recanted in 2001, as I understand it. Then you said Jones in 2005. Mm-hmm. And then finally in 2012. Here we are in 2019. Mm-hmm. And Chester Holman just got out of prison a month
right.
ago.
Right. Yes. The prior administrations, took a very different approach to cases like Chester's, and the reaction was essentially just to fight everything, to fight to protect the conviction, almost regardless of what was presented. I tried many, many times to present this case to the district attorney's office over the years, and just was met with complete indifference and hostility. Truly was not until Larry Krasner was elected and there was a administration willing to take a very sober and careful look at the evidence and the information and give us access to the homicide file, which
I wanted to raise that actually and raise that with you, Patricia, which is having access to this police file. What was in the file? Why was that important?
Let me kind of tackle that with a general statement. One of the things that I think has fundamentally been wrong with the criminal justice system, not just in Philadelphia, but probably in our country, is that we have not opened our files as prosecutors to the defense.
Aren't you supposed to do that? Isn't information supposed to be shared between prosecution and defense?
It's not that simple.
Okay.
Probably the closest that we have come to that concept is the Brady versus Maryland Supreme Court case that was handed down over 50 years ago. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court told us all that in order to basically honor and follow a defendant's right to due process, we have to make sure that we share any evidence that's favorable with them. Interestingly, even though the court told us that all of those decades ago, the court has never said that equates to opening our file to the defense. So many states have statutes that allow prosecutors to essentially make decisions about what's going to be turned over. And that has happened in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania for a long time. I'm from Texas, and I'll tell you, it took decades for Texas to finally understand as a state that operating under those old rules of you don't have to open your file is what leads to wrongful convictions more often than not. So Texas passed the Michael Morton Act. A former client of mine who had been exonerated after 25 years and said, open up your files, prosecutors. Let's cut down on the chances that these things are going to reoccur. And so from my perspective, coming from that background, to me, I don't need the state telling me I can do it. I, as a prosecutor, think ethically and morally the right thing to do is to open the file. And that's indeed what we did when we met. And Alan, I'm looking at you because those conversations and opening the file started in April of 2018.
2018 and a very significant move in this case.
Correct. If I don't want to interrupt you, Marty, but We sat down in the district attorney's office with the homicide file, it was like a Hollywood moment. I opened the file. The first thing I took out of this file was a memo that summarized a tip that the police received on the night of this crime, the night of the murder. There was a tip identifying a person who was involved in the crime, and it gave the address and some other details about this person. Well, it wouldn't you know it, that person that was identified in the anonymous tip happened to be one of the three people who had rented the identical vehicle on the night of the murder. That evidence, that information was known to the police the day of the crime, was never turned over, nor was information that the police obtained when they went out and interviewed this person. None of that was turned over. None of that was known to the defense. And it was available the day the crime happened.
And do you think if the defense had known that Chester Holman III would not have gone to prison?
I think he probably would never have gone to trial.
Gone to trial.
I think that information would have led to the case ultimately being withdrawn.
So here we are talking about all these legal cases that swirled around your case. Meanwhile, you're in prison while all of this is going on, and you have been convicted of a very serious crime.
Yes.
Did you? I mean, as things were sort of beginning to take shape, did this make you angry?
I wouldn't say I was angry. Confused. Like I said, from the onset, I've never been like. I don't know why. You know, I don't know why. You know, I ask myself that sometimes. You know, why am I mad? Yeah. But like I said, I think it was just more disappointment. Not being able to understand, because like I said, growing up, you know, I was just always taught that the police and the justice system is, you know, is fair and they get it right. You know, I never experienced anything or, you know, knew of anything like this. So, you know, the whole thing has always been like just disappointment, you know, and I was just hoping that someone would get it right. And, you know, within the, you know, I've never faulted like the police as a whole.
Yeah.
I look at individuals. I look at people, and I know the individuals that I dealt with on this evening, you know, was the cause of how this all got started, you know, so I can't fault the judge, because if the police officers that evening would have did their jobs correctly, it never would have reached the judge, it never would have reached, you know, the Department of Corrections, so I can't fault the people following what happened that night, you know, because I know where it started, so, you know, so my disappointment is started there, but like I said, it's not anger.
Yeah.
It's, you know, or frustration. It's just disappointment in what happened and disappointment in me not getting the life that I thought I was going to have, you know, and, you know, so that's where I'm at with it. So.
I read in the, I guess it was the Philadelphia Inquirer, that as a kid, you wanted to be a police officer?
Along those lines. I mean, that was my first initial, you know, dream to be, and then, you know, then I was venture off to maybe the IRS working as an, you know, accountant or something. But I did want to be somewhere in the law enforcement field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if it's necessarily a police officer, because, you know, I don't want to get shot or, you know, something along those lines. But, you know, I wanted to be in this field. Yes,
yeah.
I did.
Yeah. And in prison, what did you learn? How did you spend your time?
Well, at 21, you know, you got a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of fear, because, like I said, I was thrown into an environment that I just wasn't, you know, I knew nothing about. So,
afraid for your life at times?
Initially, the first few days, but mm-hmm. like, with me, I tend to watch. I tend to watch, and that's how I learn and I listen. So I didn't move too quickly. So when I went in that first day, they put me in the back of a block, and like I said, I just sat there in the bed, and a couple guys came in, and, you know, older guys, and, you know, for whatever reason, they just told me, you know, to, you know, mind my business, you know, stay to myself, don't open yourself up too fast, and just watch. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I watched, I listened, I learned, you know, I saw who to stay away from, you know, what to stay away from. And, you know, I tried to stay active as far as like whatever activities they may have had, whether it be cards or sports and so forth. That's what I did, you know, and stayed on the phone, calling my mother all the time.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. I read you were a model prisoner.
Well, I don't know about model prisoner, but I mean,
I just tried
to do the right thing.
Right.
I mean, because like I said, I knew people weren't listening to me as I was saying I was innocent. So I said, you know, from the very beginning that I had to show people that this is who I am. So yeah. I let my actions speak louder than my words were, you know, were saying. So that's what I did.
Well, Ellen, I mean, this case makes me mad. I mean, I appreciate the fact, Chester, that you're, you know, that you're not that kind of a person. I mean, that's clear. That's what we're learning from you. But how did you get involved in this case, then?
So So Chester had an appeal when Andre Dawkins had recanted. He was
he was one of the people that
was one of the witnesses. There was a prior attorney who filed a petition seeking, you know, a new trial or relief for Chester. That was denied, and it was on appeal. And the Holmans were looking to hire new counsel. I was working at a firm at the time, and they came to our firm and asked us to do the appeal. And we accepted that. I was working on the appeal, and while the appeal was going on, while it was in the Court of Appeals, that's when Deirdre Jones's recantation came in. Mm-hmm. It was a real. I mean,
the
I believed
eyewitness.
I was
yeah.
pretty confident Chester was innocent. You know, just having read what I read. But when I got that recantation, that's really hooked me. And I basically said, I will fight this case until I'm done working. And that's essentially what happened.
Well, and there was another piece of evidence, as I understand, Patricia, in this file that you got related to an investigator?
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is a little bit of what Alan discussed a while ago, which is Deirdre Jones and her recantation was heard by the trial court, and the trial court denied relief. Missing from that hearing was evidence that showed that the officer who took the statement had actually been in trouble or been disciplined. That's probably the most accurate way to describe it, had been disciplined for how he had handled interviewing a suspect previously, when the suspect, what gave rise to the discipline is that the suspect had actually requested counsel, and this detective denied that person their right to counsel, which was so significant because what Deirdre Jones said was very similar to that. And so had that information been made available at the time that hearing took place, the judge might have made a different decision because the officer's credibility was kind of juxtaposed to Deirdre Jones, and the judge had to make a call. And so without that evidence impeaching that officer's credibility, the judge, you know, decided that the officer was more credible than Deirdre Jones.
And what's so striking, and there's so many things, is just how justice hangs on such a small but significant piece of evidence.
Absolutely.
I mean, by a thread.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's
well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We've got some folks that want to join us, and we're talking with and about Chester Holmes III. He's sitting across from me, and for 28 years, he served in a state prison in Luzerne County here in Pennsylvania for a murder he did not commit. Alan Tauber is his lawyer. He's also an attorney in private practice who focuses on criminal defense and civil rights. Patricia Cummings with us as well. She's an assistant district attorney for the city of Philadelphia, also directs the Conviction Integrity Unit. We're talking about what happened to Chester Holman III, but also what it says about our judicial system and what, if anything, can be done to bring reforms to that system. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Chester Holmes III. He spent 28 years, Holman III. He spent 28 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Just got released about a month ago. Also with us, his lawyer, Alan Tauber, and a prosecutor, Patricia Cummings. Let me read from Kate, who says, how in the world can you ever compensate someone like Chester who's been unjustly imprisoned for 28 years? You were saying earlier, Chester, of how much that apology meant to you. Yes. Do you think you're owed something else?
I mean, I really haven't given that much thought.
No.
You know, like I said, the whole thing was, from day one, was about, you know, getting back home, right. You know. So my release was, and I had my name cleared, you know, because like I said, this is like a, it's embarrassing, you know, and I know people don't understand what that means, but it's embarrassing. You know, you've been accused of, you know, taking someone's life. And, you know, I've never lost sight of that. That's why I try not to say too much about the situation because, like I said, a man died here and I'm associated with that. So with that being said, it's like I don't feel like I'm entitled to anything at the same time. But like I said, I just wanted to kind of get my freedom and just go about my way. But I do understand that, you know, the story has to be told and,
sure.
You know, these things have to be brought to light as far as, you know, the injustices that do happen, and like a lot of people just don't know. But as far as compensation, I never gave it much thought until, like I said, you know, now that I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do,
yeah,
and how I'm going to live, and you know, I just can't continue to live off my father and my family. So, you know, it's something I'm thinking about now. But you know, prior, it wasn't a thought.
You said an important and powerful thing that while you were cleared, you still feel associated with what happened.
Yeah, because there's going to be people who just like question. Because I served 28 years in prison, so it's still gonna, that stigma, you know, is associated to my name. So it's like, you know, and that's what I have to, you know, live with going forward. And like I said, I just try to prove myself by the way I act, the way I carry myself, and you know, I try to let people see that opposed to anything I can ever say. And,
Alan, let me turn to you. Mm-hmm. And in Pennsylvania, there is no compensation for someone who's been unjustly convicted, correct?
That's correct. There are many states. If I understood this right, there's 33 states that have passed laws that will compensate individuals who have been wrongly incarcerated or exonerated. And those, they vary, you know, what fair compensation is varies from state to state. In Pennsylvania, there is no such fund. There probably should be. There's been no initiative for that at this point. So the only recourse someone like Chester has would be to pursue a civil rights action. That's his right, and he's considering that. But he's freed from jail. He's got no resources. He's got no training or skills, and he's now left to fend for himself. Thank God, he's got a family to support him. But he's been leaning on his family his whole life, and really wants to be independent.
Sure.
Wants to be on his own.
Yeah. Let me turn to you, Patricia, because it was prosecutors who put him away. I mean, here he is a man cleared of a terrible crime, and yet still feeling as if he can't extricate himself from what he was accused of. What can prosecutors, what can district attorneys do to help someone like Chester Holman III?
Unfortunately, prosecutors, and I'm going to say people in general, can't ever fully compensate Chester Holman. The reality is 28 years of his life was stolen from him, and he can't get that back. What we can do is we can accept responsibility when we were part of the cause. I think that is going back to what we discussed earlier, which is we've got to apologize. We've got to say we're sorry. And then I think as prosecutors, what we need to do is we need to be actively involved in trying to make sure that what can be compensated for actually is. Mm. And specifically, I will say this really just from a personal point of view. Most of the country is getting on board. We understand as human beings that at a minimum, we need to be financially taking care of these folks that we put in prison that are innocent.
At the most basic.
The most basic. And actually, Alan says 33 states. It was 35 states a couple of months ago, and it's growing.
Yeah. Not Pennsylvania.
And Pennsylvania needs to get on board.
There have been 7 cases. Were you involved in them all this year, Patricia, of people who sort of like our guest Chester Holman, who served time and were released basically actually innocent?
So the short answer is yes, I was involved. But I want to be very careful to say that the office, in regard to all 7, has not specifically said that we think all of them are innocent.
Okay.
When we talk about this topic, people need to understand that oftentimes there is a distinction between those people that are wrongfully convicted and those people that are in fact actually innocent of the crime they were convicted of.
A subtle but important distinction.
Very.
Ellen says, does the Philadelphia District Attorney care about pressing charges against false testimony in court cases? I mean, it seems there are a number of unanswered questions related to this case, the fact that there were people that apparently gave false testimony. Ellen?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you historically that it's my experience that the district attorney has not generally pursued charges against people who recant their statements. There's different kinds of false statements. I mean, certainly in a case like Chester's, you want people to feel they can come forward and do the right thing and recant without the fear of facing charges. There are other cases, obviously, where people give false testimony for different motives, and there should be consequences for that. I can just say historically, it's unusual. I have not really seen the office bring charges. I'm grateful they did not in this case. I think the witnesses in this case did the right thing, and I'm sure they have.
They've recanted,
and they had their own personal reckonings with what they've done, for sure.
And my understanding, Patricia, is that the two people who falsely pointed to Chester Holman said that they felt coerced by the police.
Right, and I'm glad you did that follow-up question, because this is a very, very complicated, sticky issue. First, let me say the district attorney absolutely cares about people who testify falsely. If you have people testifying falsely, whether or not they're witnesses in the neighborhood or police officers, you are compromising the very ideals that our criminal justice system is built in. So no doubt. Beyond that, though, it's so important to at least recognize that it is very difficult to prosecute. And unfortunately, I think in years past, the district attorney's office used the threat of prosecution as a sword to try to prevent actual innocence claims coming to light. And I just want to briefly highlight the case of John Miller, another individual who was actually released just very recently, and his case involved a recanting witness who said, "I said John Miller was involved, but I lied." And at the time, the district attorney's office prosecuted that witness for perjury. And so in that instance, it was using it as a sword to try to prevent this kind of holistic view to see if, in fact, we've actually gotten it wrong when we prosecuted somebody. So we have to be very careful, and we have to be very thoughtful in trying to figure out the cases that actually require the look so as to determine whether or not perjury charges should result.
Right. I mean, complicated but important. Again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll get to a caller in just a moment. But let me go back to you, Chester, then. I mean, as you look forward and look about, you're going to be making some decisions, I guess, about where to live and what kind of work that you want. What are you interested in?
You know, I've been asked that question a few times, and I still don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that's okay.
You know, I don't know what I want to do. You know, as far as like where I would want to live, like my father has gotten. You know, when I went to prison, my father was my age. I am now, so you know, and he's like 76 now, right. And you know, so I'm kind of obligated to like kind of take care of him now. So therefore, that's kind of my life.
Right.
You know, so wherever I go, I got to take my father. That's how I'm feeling. So, you know, I'm keeping that in, you know, in my head. So I really haven't figured it out. Like, so yeah. I've just been taking everything slow, and, you know, I don't know what I want to do. You know, I just, like, I'm just grateful and thankful to Ms. Cummings and, you know, Larry Krasner and Mr. Tarver, the people who helped me to, you know, receive my freedom. You know, there's a lot of people that helped me along the way. And yeah. Like I said, to be here. So I'm just, like, taking all this in and, you know, I figured that out. I figured I was going to start doing it maybe Monday.
Yeah.
You know, I would just like really start focusing on that aspect of my life and where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do. But like this last 30 days, it's just been like just looking around, just taking everything in.
Well, I'm interested in your answer because it almost feels like an unfair question because, you know, here you are just trying to acclimate to life, a very different life for yourself. And the idea that, well, now you have to figure out what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
Right.
I mean, in certain ways, it is an unfair question.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, no, it's a fair question. But like I said, I just haven't figured it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have had an answer, but I just,
no, it's,
you know, I'm just like, I'm just taking it all in.
Yeah, yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Alan?
No, I know that, you know, I've spent a lot of time with Chester since he's been released. And I know that the most immediate issue is to sort of adapt to a different routine, a different life, a different way of interacting with people. Just becoming comfortable with, you know, basic human connections that are vastly different in a prison institutional context. So I think I would expect that's going to take a while.
Sure.
I would say we met with we met with a couple of other exonerees, John Berry, who's been out for about a year, and it was very heartening to listen to John Berry talk about his experience because he expressed the same scenario where it took him some time, but seeing him a year from his date of release, he seemed pretty well adjusted and very reflective, and that was inspiring and heartening, to see, I think.
Well, and I think it underscores the fact that, you know, once you have your freedom after all this time, it's not like you can sort of turn your back on those 28 years. It's still a matter of trying to process all that and then acclimating, obviously, to a very, very different life. Let me get Kate from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. And Kate, go ahead. You're on the air.
You've answered a lot of my questions, the people on your show. This is very important discussion you have.
Thanks.
The thought that occurs to me is that maybe the wronged person who's had his life and his good reputation taken wrongly away from him could, at some point when he sorts things out, become have some sort of a public role, like maybe talking with other prisoners, maybe talking as a public speaker, or maybe on the TED Talks, or maybe talking to schools, or the justice system is so screwed up, if this kind of thing can happen, where a totally innocent person is completely robbed of everything that matters to any of us. I'm outraged when I hear this.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You want to say anything back to her?
Well, no,
she's got your life planned out for you.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah. You know, it feels good to hear. Right. But as far as like staying in this, you know, this sort of, you know, telling the story over and over, is like I don't think it allows me to move forward.
Yeah.
And that's what I really want to do. But at the same time, like I said, I understand that it has to be told and it has to be brought to light and so forth. But I just don't know how far I can go with it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, that's such an important point. Go ahead, Patricia.
I really appreciate the comment because I was thinking along those lines as I was listening to Chester speak a minute ago. And I just have to say, my experience in dealing with other people similarly situated as Chester is these are people that haven't chosen this life. This has happened to them. And despite that, they have this incredible power now, and they have choices now as to how they want to harness that power. And certainly, if Chester chooses, he can have a powerful voice that can help us learn and make sure that we minimize the chances of it happening again. And it's going to be up to Chester.
Well, I also feel it's up to the rest of us. If we're going to reform our judicial system so that someone isn't wrongly convicted, we need to take a really hard look. I'm looking at you, Alan. We're almost out of time here. But, I mean, this is a case that just cries out for some kind of intervention.
It does. I mean, I think that there very, very important, strong steps have been taken through, you know, in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, which I think is maybe viewed as a model around the country, and I know has been getting a lot of attention. And I think the work Chester's case and other cases has been an inspiration to many other district attorneys to start up, you know, similar units like this. So I would just say that, you know, obviously, you know, I think it's only fair to say Chester is entitled to, at this point, to lead his life however he wishes. You know, he certainly doesn't owe anyone anything at this point. You know, and you know, hopefully he'll find ways to take the experience and inspire others. But I don't think anybody could say with any fairness at all that you know, he has any obligation at this point to anything other than himself and his family, and to try to make the rest of his life a happy and satisfying experience.
You're here, Chester Holman III. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. I know it wasn't easy, and I appreciate you coming in and spending the hour with us. Alan Tauber, thank you for joining us as well. And he is Chester Holman's lawyer, an attorney in private practice, focuses on criminal defense and civil rights. Patricia Cummings, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
And she's an assistant district attorney for the city of Philadelphia, directs the Conviction Integrity Unit. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.